Chapter 8, A Growing United States Grows Less United. If you lived in North Carolina in the antebellum decades, your family would likely have been farmers. As you learned in Chapter 7, these farmers met most of their economic needs by what they could produce themselves. Because farming required a lot of labor, it was an advantage to have a large family. The average family had 5 or 6 people in a house, some had many more. A problem arose as the children grew older. Where would they live and raise their own children? A farm that could feed one family could not necessarily feed the families of the younger generations. In general, the oldest male child would expect to inherit the family farm when the father died. What happened when there were multiple brothers? Farmers often had little cash money with which to buy land. You also learned in Chapter 7 that farmers did not have a good understanding of how to manage soil. Nutrients were used up by over-farming or washed away by erosion in many areas. These two problems reduced the size of crops on many of our state's farms. Good land could be found that was cheap or free on the western frontier in faraway places like Kentucky and Tennessee. Many North Carolinians joined thousands of their fellow Americans who migrated westward in search of greater economic opportunity. In North Carolina and other southern states, much of the labor on larger farms was done by slaves. A young North Carolinian who wanted to go into the farming business in the West might expect to use slave labor. But many Americans in other parts of the nation were beginning to speak out against slavery, and resistance was starting to grow against allowing slavery to expand beyond the southern states. The effect of winning several wars, purchasing territory from other countries, and pushing the native peoples further west opened a vast frontier. For decades, Americans tried to build a prosperous future there. New inventions made moving west an easier task, and these new inventions helped farmers trade their goods more easily with the rest of the world. Section 1. Growth of the Western Lands. As you read, look for a land purchase that doubled the size of our nation, Andrew Jackson's role in the War of 1812 and in Indian removal, how victories over Mexico helped fulfill manifest destiny, the addition of Oregon and California to the United States, and the following terms: impressment, embargo, Indian Removal Act, manifest destiny, and Gadsden Purchase. At the start of the 19th century, the United States was a youngster compared to the dominant countries of the world. England, France, and Spain were among a group of powerful nations with more than 1,000 years of history. The United States, on the other hand, had declared its independence only 24 years earlier. The other countries judged themselves and others by their financial strength, their military power, and the amount of land they controlled. The United States was relatively undeveloped. It had a small army and only about a half dozen ships in its navy. The United States did have a good bit of land, however, and an opportunity arose that allowed the country to double its size: the Louisiana Purchase. During this time, thousands of Americans tried to move west of the Appalachians to take advantage of fresh soil and access to a port that could ship their goods almost anywhere on earth. All the rivers that ran west from the ridge of the Appalachians eventually went into the Mississippi River. This allowed access to the Port of New Orleans, a city established by the French early in the colonial period. A group of North Carolinians from the Catawba River area settled near Cape Girardeau, in today's state of Missouri, in hopes of taking advantage of this trade. Americans did not have a guarantee that they could use the Port of New Orleans. Although the Mississippi was part of the nation's border, New Orleans still belonged to Spain. On several occasions, the Spanish government closed the port, shutting down trade and destroying the expected profits of businessmen and farmers alike. The frustration of Western settlers was great. Some even supported the idea of breaking away from the United States, forming their own country, and taking the lower Mississippi River area by force from Spain. In the meantime, France, under the military leader Napoleon Bonaparte, was fighting a number of expensive wars in an effort to expand its territory. Napoleon had made a secret deal with King Charles IV of Spain to return Louisiana to French control. President Thomas Jefferson learned of this deal and asked James Monroe to go to Paris to explore the idea of buying New Orleans for the United States. Jefferson wrote to Monroe that he had the unlimited confidence of the administration and of the Western people. Jefferson added, "All eyes, all hopes are now fixed on you, for on the event of this mission depends the future destinies of this republic." The United States government was not wealthy, but with settlers in the West demanding uninterrupted access to the river and port system, Congress gave Monroe permission to spend approximately $9 million for the purchase. He sailed to Paris to complete the mission in March of 1803. Were the French interested in selling the city? How much would it cost? What he learned from the French was a shock. Napoleon was willing to sell not only the city of New Orleans, but all of Louisiana. He needed the money to continue his military expansion. By May, the American negotiation team agreed to a price of $15 million for approximately 828,000 square miles of land. Monroe knew he had not been given permission to spend that amount of money. However, he believed the offer to be such a great deal for the United States that he signed the agreement anyway. President Jefferson was thrilled with the transaction because it seemed the United States was getting almost unlimited space to build an empire of liberty. Also, with France out of the picture, the United States would have one less European power to deal with on its borders. Spending such a huge sum of money went against Jefferson's usual thinking about governmental authority and spending. Jefferson knew the Constitution had not granted him the power to make the purchase, but he felt that it was in the growing nation's best interest to buy the land. Although a few, like North Carolina's frugal, not wasteful, Congressman Nathaniel Macon opposed the deal, most Americans were excited to see their country grow so quickly and gain control of miles of rivers and the port at New Orleans. Congress approved the deal and agreed to borrow money for the purchase. With the signing of a few papers over the course of a few months, the United States doubled in size. The War of 1812. The British and the French were in conflict again in the early 1800s, and the young United States was unable to stay out of the problem. Americans believed that, as a neutral country, they should be able to trade with both Great Britain and France. The British and French had other ideas. As mentioned in Chapter 7, one British strategy to improve its navy and hurt France was to kidnap American sailors. This practice was called impressment. For example, an American ship carrying passengers, mail, and goods would set sail from a city such as Baltimore, Maryland. As it traveled toward its destination, perhaps a port in the Mediterranean Sea, a British warship would come alongside and fire a cannon across the bow of the American ship, forcing it to slow or stop. The American sailors would be required to line up on deck, and a British officer would select several of them, claim that they were British, and drag them off to serve on his own ship. In addition to impressment, the British ordered American merchants not to trade in certain types of goods. They even stopped and boarded American ships at sea to determine if the Americans were following British rules. Finally, the British forbade American ships from trading in certain ports in Europe. All of these actions angered Americans. The French were also guilty of trying to make rules for the Americans. Napoleon said that his ships were allowed to capture any American ship that had landed at a British port. Also, if an American ship had been boarded by the British and then set free, it could be captured by a French ship. Because the United States had a weak navy, there was very little it could do to defend itself from the actions of the British and French. President Jefferson's plan was to issue an embargo, a government order that limits trade in some way. No American merchant ships were allowed to sail to any foreign country. Goods such as cotton, lumber, and flour from the United States would not be available in Europe. Americans would not be able to buy china, glass, tools, wines, and other goods from Europe. Jefferson believed that Europeans' demand for trade would cause Napoleon and the British to treat American merchant ships more respectfully. By 1812, there was no improvement in relations. In fact, the British had begun providing weapons to Native Americans along the frontier. As a result, the United States declared war on Great Britain. The British had hundreds of thousands of soldiers and sailors with over 1,000 ships. The United States Navy consisted of only 16 ships. It seemed unlikely that the Americans could have an outright win against the British, but they had beaten them before. The war lasted nearly 3 years. Fighting took place along the Canadian border, the Atlantic coast, and in the Gulf of Mexico around New Orleans. Americans had great victories in the Great Lakes, but eventually Great Britain was able to blockade the Atlantic coast, keeping American ships stuck in port and unable to trade. British troops sailed up the Chesapeake Bay and up the Potomac River in 1814. After they attacked Washington, D.C. and burned the Capitol, the White House, and numerous other buildings, they later attacked Baltimore, Maryland. It was from this battle that Francis Scott Key later penned the Star-Spangled Banner, which has become our national anthem. More than 8,000 British troops were sent to capture New Orleans in January 1815. Such a capture would allow the British to control or stop trade from the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. The Battle of New Orleans did not go well for the British. Andrew Jackson, born in North Carolina, was the general sent to defend the city. He and his men held off the British attack with only 13 casualties compared to over 2,600 casualties on the British side. A treaty between the United States and Great Britain had been signed in Belgium on December 24, 1814, before the Battle of New Orleans. Unfortunately for the dead, news traveled slowly, and the Battle of New Orleans did not influence the war's outcome. Jackson did benefit, however. His victory in New Orleans made him both popular and famous. 14 years later, he was elected the 7th President of the United States. Removal of the Native People. When George Washington was president, it is thought that about half of the territory of the United States was occupied by Native Americans. Many of the tribes had been moving west as a result of the growth of white settlement. As settlers crossed the Appalachian Mountains and expanded into new lands, skirmishes, brief battles, were bound to occur. Treaties made between the United States and the natives often did not last as pressure mounted for the government to use its military power to remove the Indians once and for all. In the Northwest Territory, the Shawnee leader Tecumseh tried to unite the smaller tribes to increase their military strength. Tecumseh's power grew into a legitimate threat to the settlers, and William Henry Harrison was charged with protecting the frontier. In November 1811, Harrison defeated Tecumseh in a battle known as the Battle of Tippecanoe. This loss weakened but did not destroy the Indian threat. It did push the Indians further west and out of the Northwest Territory. Tecumseh's ideas split the tribes of the Southeast. Those that wanted to fight were called Red Sticks, and those that wanted peace were called White Sticks. During the War of 1812, many of the Red Sticks fought with the British against the United States. On August 30, 1813, 1,000 Red Sticks attacked Fort Mims in present-day Alabama. About 400 people were killed by the Red Sticks, including women and children. Cries of "Remember Fort Mims" were heard all over the country. Troops from Georgia, Tennessee, and the new Mississippi Territory began attacks in the Creek Territory. Over the course of a year, more battles were fought. On March 27, 1814, General Andrew Jackson finally defeated the Red Sticks in Alabama. Jackson forced the Creek to sign a treaty giving most of their land to the United States government. Jackson gained fame and experience that helped position him for his role in the Battle of New Orleans less than a year later. Andrew Jackson took office as president in March of 1829. Jackson had been friendly to the Native Americans, especially the Cherokee, when he needed their help fighting the Red Sticks. However, he was wise enough politically to know that white voters wanted Native Americans removed from the southern states. In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act. This law called for all Native Americans to be moved to the Western Territories. The Choctaw in Alabama and Mississippi were actually the first to be removed under the power of the Indian Removal Act. After years of broken treaties, fighting, and failed ideas, the surviving Creek were finally moved west. The discovery of gold in North Georgia encouraged rapid removal of the Cherokee. As described in Chapter 7, most Cherokee were forced westward from their towns and farms. While some in North Carolina had a different outcome, most were destined to make the difficult trek westward on the Trail of Tears. In December 1835, a hastily signed treaty with a small group of tribal leaders proved a bad deal for the Cherokee. They received a small amount of food and a little money to make the trip west. National leaders such as Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and Davy Crockett, born in North Carolina in the area that became Tennessee, tried to negotiate a better deal for the Cherokee. There was little support in Congress for their position. In May 1838, only about 2,000 Cherokee had left their homes. General Winfield Scott was ordered to remove about 15,000 Cherokee who refused to move. Hundreds of Cherokee men, women, and children died of disease while imprisoned and waiting for removal. By the time the Cherokee finally reached the Indian Territory in the West, nearly one-third of the group had died. President Jackson left office in 1837. His successor, Martin Van Buren, noted in his address to Congress in December 1838 that the measures of the removal have had the happiest effect. The Cherokees have emigrated, moved out, without apparent reluctance. However, from the Cherokee point of view, the move was a disaster. The Cherokee called the move to Indian Territory Nuna da Utsunyi, or the Trail Where They Cried. Between the Indian Removal Act of 1830 and the Trail of Tears, more than 100,000 Native Americans were displaced from 200 million acres of land that had been theirs for hundreds of years. The Lone Star Republic. In 1845, a journalist wrote that it was the manifest destiny of our country to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free descendants of our yearly multiplying millions. Manifest destiny reflected the belief of some Americans that the United States had been chosen to control all the land between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. James K. Polk, born in Mecklenburg County in 1795, became the 11th President of the United States in March 1845. His campaign promises included expansion of U.S. territory, including Texas, Oregon, and California. During his time as president, Polk oversaw events that did, in fact, grow the territory of the country and encourage the belief in manifest destiny. Thousands of white settlers moving west chose Texas as their destination. Texas, however, was a territory of Spain until 1821, when Mexico, which included Texas, won its independence. Although Mexico was a republic and modeled somewhat on the style of government in the United States, there were differences. The Mexican government encouraged settlement, but immigrants were expected to become Mexican citizens. They were also expected to become a part of the Roman Catholic religion if they were not already. In addition, slavery was outlawed in Mexico. By 1834, Anglos outnumbered Spanish Mexicans 4-1. The English-speaking settlers generally ignored Mexican laws and regarded themselves as Texians rather than Mexican subjects. Antonio López de Santa Anna was commanding general and president of Mexico in 1833. He was determined to take control of the situation. A new Mexican constitution took away many of the special privileges of the Texians and made immigration to Texas illegal. Furious over the changes, the Texians declared their independence. Santa Anna sent about 2,000 troops against the rebellious Texians. He quickly took control of the capital in San Antonio, but was not able to capture the Alamo, an old Spanish mission where about 190 Texians were determined to make a stand. After a siege of 12 days, Santa Anna's troops stormed the fort. All the Texas settlers were killed, including the legendary Jim Bowie, famous for the Bowie knife, and Davy Crockett. Four of the defenders were North Carolinians, most notably Sampson County native Macajah Autry, who wrote before the battle, I go the whole hog in the cause of Texas. A few weeks later, Santa Anna ordered the execution of 350 other Texians held as prisoners of war. These two events infuriated and inspired the American immigrants. Within 2 months, Sam Houston led 800 men into battle against Santa Anna at the Battle of San Jacinto. With cries of "Remember the Alamo" ringing in the air, the Texians defeated Santa Anna's army on April 21, 1836, and gained Texas's independence from Mexico. The people of Texas formed a new country, the Republic of Texas, also known as the Lone Star Republic. They wanted to become a part of the United States as quickly as possible. However, because slavery was allowed in Texas, statehood was delayed until 1845. North Carolinian James P. Henderson, originally from Lincolnton, was chosen as the state's first governor. He had previously been the Republic's ambassador to Great Britain. The Mexican-American War. After the annexation of Texas, Mexico cut all diplomatic ties with the United States. President Polk offered to buy California and New Mexico from Mexico and pay off Mexico's debts in exchange for establishing the border between the two countries at the Rio Grande River. Mexico responded by invading Texas. Two principal American armies advanced into Mexico, one from the Rio Grande and the other from the port of Veracruz on the eastern shore of Mexico. Eventually, after hard fighting, the Americans captured the capital, Mexico City, in September 1847. Mexico was forced to surrender, and terms were negotiated in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. The United States gained 500,000 square miles of territory, now California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, most of New Mexico, and parts of Wyoming and Colorado. Mexico dropped its claims on Texas and set the border at the Rio Grande. Polk agreed to pay Mexico $18.25 million. In 1853, through the Gadsden Purchase, the United States negotiated the purchase of the southern part of New Mexico for $10 million. The border of the southern continental United States you know today was now set. Oregon and California. Another land area desired by the United States was the Oregon Territory. This region was west of the Rocky Mountains and north of California. Great Britain and the United States had an ongoing dispute over the location of the boundary between Canada, under British rule, and the United States. After many negotiations, war was averted and the boundary was set at the 49th parallel, 49 degrees north latitude. The Oregon Treaty of 1846 created a 2,175-mile-long border that split the Oregon Territory. The northern half went to the British in Canada, the southern portion went to the United States. With this expansion of territory, America's borders extended from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. Manifest destiny had been achieved. Thousands of pioneers headed west, moving into new territories. Their reasons for migrating west were many. Some wanted adventure, while some looked for riches. Many wanted new lands for farming, mining, or trapping. Some, such as the Mormons, were escaping religious persecution. Others wanted to escape the overcrowded cities of the East Coast. The Oregon and Santa Fe trails were the favored routes west. Settlers rode months in covered wagons across barren and hostile lands, facing Indian attacks, severe weather, the harsh Rocky Mountains, and frontier hardships. Many died along the way and were buried along the trails. But none of the hardships stopped thousands from leaving their homes once they heard the word gold. In 1848, John Marshall was building a lumber mill for John Sutter on California's American Fork River. He discovered something yellow and shiny in the river. Marshall had discovered gold. The two men tried to keep the discovery a secret, but by 1849, word got out, and a national stampede to the west began. The so-called 49ers traveled in covered wagons, on horseback, and on foot to reach the gold fields. They came not just over land, but also by ship around Cape Horn in South America and by mule train from Panama. Mining camps sprang up overnight, as over 80,000 people rushed to California. Between 1848 and 1850, the population of California grew tenfold. Many who traveled in search of riches never found any gold, but they stayed to settle the frontier territory as trappers, ranchers, and farmers. Special feature: Carolina and U.S. progress. Advances in transportation and communication. With the rapid growth of the United States came the need to travel the vast country more quickly. More speed meant faster transportation of goods to market and more quickly realized profits. Troops needed to be moved more speedily in order to defend territory, and leaders needed to send messages reliably to all parts of the continent-spanning country. Mail service could not always be counted upon, and it was certainly slow. Newspapers delivered by mail rarely contained the latest news. These were huge needs. How would they be met? Inventors and innovators found solutions that moved the country forward with greater speed and reliability. Travel by road. If you were asked how our 19th century ancestors could have solved these problems, you might suggest building roads. After all, 21st century North Carolina has a vast network of paved roads and bridges connecting the coast to the mountains. To build this excellent road system, we use bulldozers, computers, satellite imagery, asphalt, and concrete. None of these could be found in the early 1800s. North Carolina's roads in the 1800s were usually made of dirt. Full of holes and rocks, they would have made carriage rides rough and wagon rides slow. Rain and snow turned the roads muddy. Wagons made ruts in the mud that later dried, creating an even rougher path. Roads were expensive, but slowly governments at every level created plans to build and maintain roads, such as North Carolina's Buncombe Turnpike. Bridges were another matter. Many roads simply ran to a creek, and travelers were forced to ford, cross in a shallow place, the waterway. Bridges were, and are, very expensive to build and maintain. Governments were challenged to find ways to pay for them, however, because citizens demanded the ability to travel with greater speed and reliability. Travel by water. If possible, Americans shipped goods and traveled by water. Ships could cross the ocean, and flatboats could travel the rivers. Traders could build flatboats to ship goods downstream. When they arrived at their destination, they could sell the goods and then sell the wood from the boat for lumber. The traders would then find their way back upstream and start the cycle again. What made a huge difference in river travel was Robert Fulton's development of a working steamboat. In 1807, Fulton and Robert Livingston built a steamboat they called the Clermont, which carried passengers from New York City up the Hudson River to Albany, New York. The Clermont could make this 150-mile trip in only 32 hours. That trip is 3 hours by car and about an hour by air today. In 1811, the men tested travel on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers in a ship called the New Orleans. In 1814, 20 steamboats had arrived in port at New Orleans. By 1834, that number had risen to 1,200 arrivals, suggesting how important the steamboat was to the growth of the Port of New Orleans and trade along the Mississippi and Ohio River network. Another method of water travel was by canal. As mentioned in Chapter 7, canals could be expensive to build and maintain. But if successful, they could provide reliable transportation over long distances. Canal boats at first were drawn by animals such as mules or horses. The steam engine began to replace these animals to cut transport time. Entrepreneurs invested in the construction of canals. They took the risk and planned to make money back by charging users a toll. Many states encouraged canal building projects as a means of improving transportation of goods and people. Travel by rail. None of the methods of travel mentioned so far would have as great an impact as the invention of the railroad. The first rail cars were pulled along tracks by horses. Peter Cooper examined the steam engines used in steamboats and added it to the rail cars to make the first locomotive. His first attempt was the small Tom Thumb. In a challenge set to test the engine, Cooper's train lost a race to a train pulled by a horse. In the end, horses could not keep up with the power of steam engines. Cooper continued to innovate until he was able to build an engine that reliably defeated the poor horses that challenged it. Trains traveled up to 30 miles per hour, and within 2 decades, tracks were crisscrossing the country. Communication by telegraph. The difficulties in getting information across the country were real. Think about the unfortunate soldiers who died at the Battle of New Orleans. The peace treaty ending the war had been signed 3 weeks earlier, but the slow communication meant that the generals on both sides continued to fight. In 1832, artist Samuel F.B. Morse was sailing home from studying art in Europe. He learned of a discovery that allowed electricity to be sent through a length of wire. His imaginative mind began to ponder ways that such a discovery might be put to use to communicate. Examining the experiments of others and conducting experiments of his own, Morse was able to reliably send electrical signals in long and short bursts. He then created a pattern, the Morse code, to enable communication using the patterns. Morse demonstrated his telegraph in Washington, D.C., and Congress eventually approved $30,000 in 1843 for him to string wire from the U.S. Capitol to Baltimore, a distance of 37 miles. On May 24, 1844, the first message on the line, "What hath God wrought," arrived seconds after it was sent. The same message could have taken 6 hours to arrive if delivered by a rider on horseback. Within 15 years, there were more than 50,000 miles of telegraph lines connecting the country.